Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. What do Van Gogh, Vince Lombardi, Chef David Chang, and Microsoft's Bill Gates all have in common? They were transcendent at what they did. But that's not all. All of them pioneered techniques that generate success, according to psychologist and author Ron Friedman. Ron lays out the secret to their success in his book, Decoding Greatness: How the Best in the World Reverse Engineer Success. It teaches you how to learn new skills and generate creative ideas by analyzing your favorite artists, TV shows, movies, and books. Ron joined us for a fascinating chat on this alternative route to success.
There are two primary stories that most of us have heard throughout our lives. The first story is that greatness or success comes from talent. From this perspective, we're all born with certain innate strengths, and the key to achieving your greatness is finding a field that allows your strengths to shine. The second story is that greatness comes from practice. Now, according to this perspective, getting to the top requires the right practice regimen and a willingness to do a lot of hard work. But what I found in doing the research for Decoding Greatness is that, in fact, there's a third story, and that third story is reverse engineering, and it simply means finding extraordinary examples in your field and then working backward to figure out how they were created, but also how you can apply those insights to accelerate your success and succeed faster.
Mm-hmm. And one way to be successful with reverse engineering is to zoom out. One great example of this comes from studying the career of Vince Lombardi. How did a Polaroid camera help Lombardi revolutionize coaching?
Oh man, that's one of my favorite stories in the book. So Vince Lombardi paired up with Wellington Mara, who was working for the New York Giants at the time, and he got a Christmas present of a Polaroid camera. And what they both formulated together was a plan, which was Wellington Mara was going to sit in the upper deck of Yankee Stadium at the time, which is where the Giants played, and shoot photos at the start of every play and then chuck them down in a weighted sock. He stuffed the sock with a rock as well as a Polaroid camera. And when fans were looking at the play on the field, he would throw the sock in the direction of Lombardi. Lombardi would look at the photo and then share that with the rest of the team as a means of getting an aerial view of what the other team was doing. And that enabled the Giants to pick up on what it was that the defensive formation looked like so that their offense would benefit.
What the hell's going on out here?
That approach of zooming out and seeing the bigger picture is relevant to a lot more than football, because it's also true for all of us when we're trying to analyze creative works. So when you're, for example, listening to a podcast such as a radio show like this, you might get lost in the particular words. But when you zoom out and you look to see, hey, what is Doug doing in the way he's asking questions, that enables you to reverse engineer Doug's approach to asking questions. And perhaps if you're interested in becoming a host yourself, really get a much better perspective on what it takes to ask the right questions.
Hopefully, yeah, assuming I'm asking the right questions. So, yeah, thank you for using me as an example. That's a first. And I'm in good company with Vince Lombardi, so thank you very much for that. How did Sir Ken Robinson's 2006 TED Talk, Do Schools Kill Creativity, create the blueprint for all successful TED Talks?
Well, I don't know if it created the blueprints for all successful TED Talks, but what I will say is that obviously, because it's the most watched TED Talk of all time, there are some interesting insights to behold.
My contention is that creativity now is as important in education as literacy, and we should treat it with the same status. Thank you.
What I did in looking at his talk is I took out the transcript and then I analyzed it to see what is he doing in every paragraph, to what extent is he telling stories, to what extent is he sharing facts. And what I found is over the course of his entire TED Talk, he shares a grand total of one persuasive fact. That to me is a stunning revelation, because if I were to start writing a TED Talk from scratch, I'd assume that I need to plaster you with lots of persuasive facts. He does very little of that, one persuasive fact. What does he do a lot of? He tells a lot of anecdotes. A lot of them are personal, and he shares a lot of jokes. He's got an 18 or 19 minute talk. I think he does 40 jokes over the course of 19 minutes.
I find this very interesting. If you're at a dinner party and you say you work in education, actually, you're not often at dinner parties, frankly. If you work in education, you're not asked, you know, and
By deriving some of those key metrics that are buried within the presentation of his talk, you now understand his formula for presenting a TED Talk. Now, I don't know if that creates a blueprint for everyone. So, for example, if you wanted to create a TED Talk and you tried to only include one persuasive fact and tell lots and lots of jokes, I can't promise you that that's going to go viral. That was effective for him because he was one of the first to present a TED Talk. So one of the things that is interesting as you start reverse engineering is you realize that if you just replicate someone else's formula, you're not necessarily going to be successful because A, you need to account for certain strengths that the person executing them has inherently. In the case of Robinson, he's a funny guy, and he's got the academic cachet where he can get away with just telling one fact. The other element here is that audience expectations shift with time. And so if you were to replicate his precise formula, again, it may not be successful because by now, audiences have seen it already and it's no longer as novel. And so the key is not simply to use reverse engineering to replicate someone else's formula, but to just use it as an academic exercise to accelerate your learning so that you have an understanding for what it takes to be successful and then evolve that formula so that you're also being novel and fresh at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And that you're being true to yourself, that there's some authenticity there.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Comedian and film producer Judd Apatow is someone who owes a lot of his success to reverse engineering. How so?
Judd Apatow, as a teenager, knew he was interested in comedy, but he wasn't sure how to break in. So what he did was he just basically obsessed like other teenagers did over sports and over athletes. And in the case of Apatow, he would follow comedians on TV religiously. He washed dishes at the local comedy club. But he wasn't quite sure how to take it beyond that until one day when he walked into his high school and he noticed that the DJ at the station, the high school station, was interviewing a surprising range of pretty impressive rock bands. And so he got the idea that he was going to start his own radio show and use it to invite comedians and interview them.
How would you describe the type of humor that you're doing?
Oh, man.
Because it's not that conventional. It seems that, you know, when you watch it, it's like your ideas on things, and I think it's great.
I do this joke in my act that I've heard every excuse for a woman not going to bed with me. I think I've heard them all. I remember this one girl.
And he used those interviews to understand how he could break into comedy, what it took to write the right kind of joke, the amount of practice necessary to be successful. And by the time he got out of high school, he said he had built himself a Bible for breaking into comedy. And he did it by reverse engineering some of the most successful comedians of his generation.
Reverse engineering doesn't just work in the arts and entertainment world. The James Beard Award-winning chef David Chang has used it to build a culinary empire. How did he do it?
Well, one of the things that he understood in reverse engineering recipes throughout different cuisines is that in many cases, this is almost like the ratatouille effect, where it's about the way that the food triggers a memory that you've had in the past. But it's not simply about engaging past memories. It's also making sure that the food sneaks up on you in a way that you're not expecting. So in the example that I share in Decoding Greatness, he talks about Momofuku's pork buns, that Momofuku being his restaurant chain, and pork buns being the dish that put them on the map. And it's got all the elements that are in a BLT, which is it's got a fatty meat, it's got a emphatic crunch, it's got all of the elements that are inherent in a BLT, except it's a little bit foreign. And so it's got that optimal degree of feeling new while also reminding you of the past. And so that's a recipe that he has taken and applied to other dishes as well, trying to find something that reminds people of their youth, but then disguising it by adding the elements of a foreign cuisine.
The Ratatouille effect. Yeah, that's the Ratatouille effect in action. Sounds like the name of a Robert Ludlum novel. Maybe it will be. We'll see. We'll look forward to it. According to conventional wisdom, we often think of originality and creativity as the same thing. But that's not always the case, is it?
It's not. And in fact, if you confuse these two, you're going to get yourself into trouble because as it turns out, when we're completely original, that tends to backfire. And it's because as a species, we tend to be distrustful of the new. And so there's research looking at the optimal degree of novelty and what is it that really catches on. And this is research that was conducted at Harvard Business School. And what they looked at were the type of grants that get funding. And they had raters, these were experts in the medical field, evaluate the grants on the degree to which they were novel. And what they found is that the studies that were not at all novel, in other words, ones that simply replicated existing effects, those didn't get funding. The type of grant proposals that were completely novel, those also didn't get funding. So what is it that wins the most funding? And it's the applications that have a slight degree of novelty. In other words, studies that take existing findings and evolve them ever so slightly. And they call this optimal newness. Now, that turns out to be applicable to a lot more than just grant applications. If you're looking to break through in your creative field, what you don't want to do is be a complete original. That tends to backfire. You want to find successful formulas, which you can do through reverse engineering, and then you want to evolve them ever so slightly to reach your optimal newness.
Interesting. You talk about the art of elevating an overlooked ingredient, and we are huge Seinfeld fans here at Beta. How did Seinfeld use this tactic of an overlooked ingredient to become arguably the greatest sitcom of all time?
Yeah, so let me give you some context. So Seinfeld seems very different than the typical comedy, but in fact, there's one central feature that makes it different. And what Seinfeld did was they took an element that is typically buried in the background of most sitcoms and they elevated it, making a central feature of their approach. That underappreciated element is the role of minutia.
I can't spend the rest of my life coming into this stinking apartment every 10 minutes to pour over the excruciating minutia of every single daily event.
No, why not? Like yesterday, I went to the bank to make a deposit, and the teller gives me this look.
I'll see you later, man. I gotta go.
Seinfeld elevated that and made those petty aggravations really a central feature of every episode. And there's a lesson there, which is that sometimes you don't have to recreate your approach to a formula that is vastly different than what's already worked. It's simply a matter of taking something that is typically buried within a formula and elevating it. And so another example, this is in the world of marketing, where brands like Absolut Vodka have thrived not by highlighting how the taste of their vodka is superior to others, but rather by focusing on the bottle. So that's another example of how you can take an overlooked ingredient and make it a central feature of your approach. So in the case of Absolut, the shape of the bottle became the guiding principle by which all of their advertising was conducted. So if you've ever seen any of those ads on magazines or bus stops where you see the shape of the Absolut bottle in some other context, and then the headline is typically Absolut Perfection or Absolut fill in the blank, whatever the case may be that is relevant to that particular image. And it's allowed them to stand out from other vodka brands and continue to be relevant many years later.
What do you consider the most creative use of reverse engineering in the history of the world? I know that's kind of a tough question, but
it's a great question. The most creative use, you know, I don't know if it's the most creative use, but I think it is one that is highly applicable and one that I have really appreciated in thinking about how to apply this to other fields. And it's the story of how Kurt Vonnegut, the famous writer, would reverse engineer popular stories. Vonnegut's technique was that he would convert words into pictures. And here's how he did it. For every story, he would draw a graph. And on that graph, he would plot the protagonist's fortune over time. In other words, how are things going for the main character from beginning to end? Are they good? Are they bad? And it was almost like giving the story an X-ray to better understand its structure. And when Vonnegut did this, he discovered two fascinating things. One is that the vast majority of stories and in books and films and theater, they fit neatly into one of six basic story arcs. And in fact, later on, many years later, there was research that looked at thousands of stories. This was analyses done by computer programmers. And what they found was that Vonnegut was right all those years ago is that, in fact, there are six basic story arcs. The second thing that Vonnegut discovered is that many of the stories that we absolutely love, the kind that have been popular for generations, are basically the same story told with different characters. Mm. So, for example, Cinderella and Annie share a remarkable degree of overlap. Both of them start with a hero who's in trouble. The hero is rescued. The hero then reverts back to dire straits until finally they're saved for good and live happily ever after. So I love that example because it shows us there's so much to be learned when you zoom out and look for patterns that exist or are hidden within the works that we appreciate that then enable us to recreate them and evolve them in new ways.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. A la the zooming out that Vince Lombardi did. Yeah.
Correct.
I love that phrase you used, giving the story an x-ray. That Monica is giving the story an x-ray. That's bang on. That's very, very evocative. How can we use reverse engineering to improve our daily lives?
There are so many answers to that question. I'll start with one idea that I think anybody can apply right away after listening to this, and that is become a collector. Now, when we think about collections, we tend to think about physical objects. We think about books or stamps or wines. That definition is too narrow. I can tell you, I know a lot of copywriters. They collect headlines. I know designers who collect logos. I'm a writer. I collect stories. I collect academic journal articles. I collect powerful opening sentences and transitions and conclusions. And having that collection either on a Google Doc in my case, or you know, you might use Pinterest if you're looking at images, that collection is vital because what it allows you to do is to compare the items in your collection against items that you didn't include in your collections. And that's like playing a game of spot the difference. Back as kids, you might recall you played a game where you had two images side by side and you compare them to determine what's distinct about image number two versus image number one. You can mm-hmm. do that same thing with the items in your collection. And if you're just someone who's not, you know, working in a creative field, perhaps you're just someone who works in an office, you can do this for well-written emails or compelling memos or websites that you found engaging. And then comparing those against ones that didn't make your collection enables you to spot differences that contribute to greatness. And so it really is about finding what it is that's different about the items in your collection against the ones that didn't make it. That enables you to identify those key ingredients that make works effective. But beyond that, it gives you an opportunity to visit what I call a private museum so that the next time you need to create your own well-written email or a compelling memo, you have something to look at to inspire you and remind you to think big.
That's great advice. Ron Friedman, thank you very much for joining us. It was a lot of fun and I learned a lot. No more forward engineering for me. I'm going reverse engineering all the way.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate the opportunity.
Ron Friedman is a social psychologist and the author of Decoding Greatness, How the Best in the World Reverse Engineer Success. You can reverse engineer the success of this interview at wpr.org/beta.
The bland boredom of suburbia for me is more the ability to try to rebel against the status quo norms that we all really willingly accept for our lives, whether they make sense or not.
Fabian Nicieza talks about his debut novel, Suburban Dicks. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.